From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
So I'm confident that the situation is improving enough on the ground that by the end of this year, we will begin to draw down significant numbers of American troops, and by the end of the next year, more than half of the troops who are there now will be home, but not because we set a deadline. That would make it harder.
Thank you, Senator.
I'll take 30 seconds,
okay,
if I might.
You've got it.
Look, it's General Casey who said we ought to start bringing our troops home, you know, as early as September or October.
That's exactly
it's the American generals who are beginning to come up with a timeline.
The polls have opened today in the most watched primary in the country. It's the Connecticut Democratic race between incumbent Senator Joe Lieberman and his anti-Iraq war challenger, Ned Lamont. We'll speak to Hartford Current columnist Bill Curry about what the primary means for Connecticut, the Democratic Party, and the country. And a prominent American banker, a Lebanese American banker, speaks out on the Middle East. Dr. Richard Debs is advisory director at Morgan Stanley and former head of the board of the American University of Beirut. He'll join us in studio. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's attack on Lebanon intensified Monday as the international community failed again in securing a ceasefire. At least 69 people were reported killed in Lebanon. Israel's now threatening to bomb all vehicles driven in southern Lebanon. Israeli planes dropped leaflets ordering residents not to travel by car or truck. Israel was also warned residents of southern Lebanon not to go outdoors after 10 p.m. For the first time, Israel bombed the Shia neighborhood, a southern suburb of Beirut. The strike destroyed a residential building and killed as many as 15 people. Shortly after the bombing, Democracy Now!'s Anna Nogueira in Beirut spoke with an attorney from the Shia neighborhood named Hassan Nizam.
There's about two families just now under this rocket. We are making the helping. Maybe you can take somebody out. This is area, the habitat, all the people, civilian. They are coming from South Lebanon. Some villages call it Deir Antar, in the second village, Al Majadel. They are leaving the danger zone area to live here. This is the first time we see the fire here in this area. No Hezbollah here, and no Amal here. This is civilian country.
The southern Lebanese city of Tyre is now largely cut off from the rest of the world. All bridges out of the city have been destroyed. On Monday, Israel bombed a makeshift bridge that had been set up to cross the Litani River. Doctors Without Borders created a 200-yard-long human chain across the river in order to get aid into the city of Tyre. Aid workers standing in knee-deep water passed more than 3 tons of medical supplies and gasoline across the river by hand. The Guardian newspaper is reporting Israel has also threatened to attack UN peacekeepers if they attempt to repair bomb-damaged bridges in southern Lebanon. The Washington Post's Anthony Shadid reports for many residents of Tyre, the current war has been more unsettling than Lebanon's 15-year civil war, more devastating than the 1982 Israeli invasion, and more destructive than Israeli offensive against Lebanon in 1993 and 1996. This is United Nations Humanitarian Coordinator David Shearer.
The situation in country is deteriorating rapidly. Since the beginning of the war, there have been virtually no supplies being brought into Lebanon, with the exception of some relief supplies. That means that Lebanon, to all intents and purposes, has been shut off from the outside world.
On the diplomatic front, the Arab League is pressing the United Nations Security Council to make changes to a draft resolution aimed at ending the fighting. Lebanon and other Arab states oppose the U.S. written resolution because the resolution does not require Israel to immediately pull out of Lebanon. This is the Arab League's U.N. observer, Yahya Mamasani.
About the respect of Lebanese sovereign integrity, the first thing you should do, get the Israelis out of Lebanese soil. Get them to behind the blue line. This is the first prerequisite of integrity and respect of Lebanon's sovereignty.
Lebanon has offered to send 15,000 troops to the border region. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert described it as an interesting offer. On Monday, President Bush held a news conference at his vacation home in Crawford, Texas.
Whatever happens in the UN, that we must not create a vacuum into which Hezbollah and its sponsors are able to move more weapons. The sometimes the world likes to take the easy route in order to solve a problem. Our view is it's time to address root causes of problems. And to create a vacuum, Suzanne, is unacceptable. It would mean that we haven't addressed the root cause.
Israeli Defense Minister Amir Peretz says Israel's preparing to expand military operations unless the United Nations quickly finds a solution. On Monday, the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert spoke via the Internet to members of the United Jewish communities.
I know you all think that we are fighting against Hezbollah. But let's face it, the state of Israel is fighting against the Iranians and the Syrians who are using the Hezbollah in order to attack Israel from the north. This is a very difficult war. For the first time, almost in the entire life of the state of Israel, not just the soldiers fight, the entire country fights.
In Britain, seven anti-war protesters were arrested Monday after trying to get in a plane at a British airport to search for U.S. weapons being transported to Israel. Three people boarded a military plane. Four others were arrested at the airport. The activists were part of the anti-nuclear group Trident Plowshares. No weapons were found by the group. In Baghdad, at least 24 people have died in a series of car bombings and shootings. In northern Baghdad, gunmen stormed a bank and killed five people. A pair of roadside bombs exploded in the Al Arabi market, killing at least 10 people. The Los Angeles Times has revealed U.S. forces committed far more massacres during the Vietnam War than has ever been publicly acknowledged. A once-secret Pentagon task force determined that every Army division that operated in Vietnam committed war crimes. The paper uncovered official government documents that detail 320 incidents of Vietnam War atrocities that were confirmed by Army investigators. In Mexico, the presidential contender, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is continuing his protest to demand a full recount in last month's presidential election. On Monday, thousands of his supporters demonstrated in front of Mexico's electoral court. López Obrador has vowed civil disobedience will intensify if a ballot-by-ballot recount is not conducted. The French organization Action Against Hunger has suspended its operations in Sri Lanka after 17 of its aid workers were murdered on Friday. The French charity said it wanted to send a team to investigate the killings, but that government soldiers prevented them from entering the town. The rebel Tamil Tigers and government forces have blamed each other for the killings. The aid workers were all ethnic Tamils. Over 440 people have died in the past 2 weeks in the Trincomalee district. In Colombo, a car bombing earlier today killed two people. The oil company BP has shut down the Prudhoe Bay oil field in Alaska after discovering an oil spill. The oil field's the largest in the country and provides 8% of the nation's crude oil production. Industry experts say the oil field might stay closed for several weeks. On Monday, oil prices surged by nearly 3%. In political news, voters in Connecticut are heading to the polls today for the closely watched Democratic primary between incumbent Senator Joseph Lieberman and Ned Lamont. We'll have more on this in a few minutes. In Georgia, Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney is facing Hank Johnson in a runoff today. Meanwhile, in New York, a controversy is emerging in the race between Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton and Democratic challenger Jonathan Tasini. The local news station, New York One, has refused to set up a debate between the two candidates because Tasini hasn't spent enough money on the race. The channel, which is owned by Time Warner, requires candidates poll at least 5% and have spent or raised $500,000. Tasini is polling at 13%, but his campaign has only raised $150,000. In other political news, the Republican Party has lost a bid to have Tom DeLay's name removed from the ballot in November. DeLay withdrew from the race after he won the Republican primary. In Chile, over 2,000 workers have gone on strike at the world's largest privately owned copper mine. The Escondida mine produces about 8% of the world's copper. Daily production has dropped by almost two-thirds because of the strike. New government records show that last month was the second hottest July on record in the United States. Last month's heat wave broke more than 2,300 daily temperature records across the United States. Meanwhile, a new video has appeared online mocking Al Gore's fight against global warming and his film Inconvenient Truth. The short video Gore appears as a sinister figure who brainwashes penguins and bores movie audiences by blaming the Mideast crisis and Lindsay Lohan's shrinking waist size on global warming. The video is purportedly the work of a 29-year-old video maker in Beverly Hills. But the Wall Street Journal has revealed the video appears to actually be the work of the public relations and lobbying company DCI Group. The company's clients include ExxonMobil. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, voters go to the polls in one of the most watched races in the primary season. Joseph Lieberman, the three-term Democratic senator from Connecticut, is facing his first major challenge to re-election since he won his seat 18 years ago. His challenger is Ned Lamont. He's a wealthy former telecommunications executive who's run largely on an anti-Iraq war platform. Senator Lieberman was the Democratic Party's vice presidential candidate in 2000 and ran for president in 2004. He's been harshly criticized for his vocal support of the Iraq war and his continued opposition to an immediate U.S. troop withdrawal. He's also been taken to task for his perceived closeness to President Bush and other Republicans. Lamont's steady gain on Lieberman has been fueled by increasing anti-war sentiment in Connecticut. A poll last week showed Lamont beating Lieberman 54-41%. The latest poll shows Lamont holding a six-point lead. Lieberman has promised to run as an independent if he loses today's primary. This is an excerpt from the Lamont-Lieberman debate that took place last month. Ned Lamont was just asked to explain the difference between him and Lieberman on the Iraq war.
Senator Lieberman, over the last 3 years, keeps saying, we're turning the corner, we're turning the corner, things are getting better and better. That corner is a square. We're not making progress in the war in Iraq right now. As you remember, the senator said over 6 months ago, look at all the cell phones, look at the satellite dishes. We're on the way to progress. In fact, in the last 6 months, the number of sectarian deaths has increased a lot. There are deaths of Americans. It's going downhill. Tom Friedman calls it anarchy. Others have called it just an incipient civil war. I think our very visible frontline military presence is making the situation worse. I think that our best hope for success, Tom, our best hope for success is to take the very American military face off of this occupation and start bringing our troops out of harm's way and start bringing our troops home. We'll be there for reconstruction. We'll be there for humanitarian assistance. We'll be there for political support. But at the end of the day, only the Iraqis can solve this. They can solve it politically, and only they can solve it militarily.
Senator Lieberman.
Well, Tom and Joanne, Ned's got me confused again. But I'll tell you one thing he's wrong about. The situation in Iraq is a lot better, different than it was a year ago. The Iraqis held three elections. They formed a unity government. They're on the way to building a free and independent Iraq. Their military, two-thirds of their military, is now ready on their own to lead the fight with some logistical backing from the U.S. or stand up on their own totally. That's progress. And the question is, are we going to abandon them while they're making that progress? Let me repeat. I'm not for an open-ended commitment to Iraq. The sooner we're out of there, the better it will be for the Iraqis and for us. But if we leave too soon, we will create disaster there, a terrorist state, civil war, regional instability, and the terrorists will be emboldened to strike us again. So I am confident that the situation is improving enough on the ground that by the end of this year, we will begin to draw down significant numbers of American troops, and by the end of the next year, more than half of the troops who are there now will be home, but not because we set a deadline. That would make it harder.
Thank you, Senator.
I'll take 30 seconds,
okay,
if I might.
You've got it.
Look, it's General Casey who said we ought to start bringing our troops home, you know, as early as September or October.
That's exactly.
It's the American generals who are beginning to come up with a timeline. It's important we set a timeline. The Maliki government is asking us to set a timeline. Many members of Congress are asking us to set a timeline. Many Iraqis are asking us to do that. The Arab League is saying, let's set a timeline. Let the Iraqis know that only they can solve this. We don't have permanent designs in our oil, their oil, no permanent military bases. Let them have a time frame that they know they're going to step up.
An excerpt of the Lamont-Lieberman debate that took place last month. Bill Curry joins us now from Hartford, Connecticut. He's a former Connecticut state controller and state senator. He was the Democratic nominee for governor in 1994 and 2004. Bill Curry was also a counselor to President Clinton from 1995 to 97. He now writes a weekly column for the Hartford Current. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Great to be with you, Amy. Thank
well,
you.
What's happening in your party in Connecticut, Bill? This race between Joseph Lieberman and Ned Lamont that all the country is watching.
Well, first of all, the race is certainly a referendum on Bush foreign policy. But at another level, I think it's also a referendum on a kind of centrism within the Democratic Party, which many Democrats feel, especially under President Bush, that their own party's centrism has become not just ineffectual, but unconscionable. And certainly this race says two things loud and clear. For any Democrat going into the Congress, should the Democrats take the majority, going into the presidential primaries, support for Bush's foreign wars ensures fierce opposition from within this party. And secondly, and particularly in the case of Senator Lieberman, support for the culture wars as well, for the Schiavo kinds of crises, for the Bill Bennetts and the Limbaughs, etc., that any trafficking in that kind of politics is just no longer, I think, going to be tolerated. People want their party to speak for pluralism, for tolerance and mutual acceptance, for a right to privacy. And I think that both of these, the war is the driving issue here without a doubt. And this party, it hasn't put an alternative on the table. It may, in fact, I think, in November win by default. But the one thing is for sure that the present course is being rejected. And so those things overwhelmingly. Over time, there's a sense among liberals in this state in particular that Senator Lieberman has made his career using them as a kind of backboard for his political bank shots, setting himself up as the sort of transcendent bipartisan moderate in opposition to the marginal sort of extremism of mainstream Democrats. And there's been a resentment brewing over that. In my state, as you said, I ran for governor twice. I'm one of the only living Americans to lose two statewide elections to a multiple felon. Here, bipartisanship has meant primarily deficit spending and corruption. In Washington, bipartisanship has meant the right of Democrats to agree with the president as loudly and as frequently as they wish. It's just no longer popular. In a world in which the two parties are no longer Democrats and Republicans, but incumbents and challengers, the senator's gifts for conciliation aren't as marketable.
Bill Curry, I wanted to talk about what effect this race is having on other races. For example, here in New York, I wanted to go to the Armed Services Committee hearing. This is where Rumsfeld had first said he would not testify publicly, only speak to senators privately. And then under a lot of pressure, he said he'd speak. And he was questioned by New York Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton.
A recent book, aptly titled Fiasco, describes in some detail the decision-making apparatus that has led us to this situation. So, Mr. Secretary, when our constituents ask for evidence that your policy in Iraq and Afghanistan will be successful, you don't leave us with much to talk about. Yes, we hear a lot of happy talk and rosy scenarios, but because of the administration's strategic blunders and, frankly, the record of incompetence in executing, you are presiding over a failed policy. Given your track record, Secretary Rumsfeld, why should we believe your assurances now?
My goodness. First, I've tried to make notes and to follow the prepared statement you've presented. First of all, it's true, there is sectarian conflict in Iraq, and there is a loss of life, and it's a unfortunate and tragic thing that that's taking place. And it is true that there are people who are attempting to prevent that government from being successful. And they are the people who are blowing up buildings and killing innocent men, women, and children, and taking off the heads of people on television. And the idea of their prevailing is unacceptable.
That's Donald Rumsfeld responding to Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, who called for Rumsfeld's resignation. Other Democratic senators have done that, but many feel this happened now very close to the Connecticut primary because of the kind of pressure that's building on Clinton as we see Joseph Lieberman behind in the polls in Connecticut. Bill Curry, your response.
Well, first of all, in terms of identifying on cultural issues and supporting the war, Senator Clinton is probably the closest to Senator Lieberman within the Senate. Bill Clinton came here to Waterbury, Connecticut, on behalf of Joe about 10 days back. And in part, it was because I believe that the consensus that he had constructed within the party, as well as his own wife's prospective fortunes in the upcoming presidential primary, should she be a candidate, are very much on the line here. And Senator Clinton is in a very different situation. One, her husband's personality transcends the factional differences within the party. His policies don't so much reconcile them as his personality engrosses them, but her connection to him gives her a buy that Senator Lieberman wouldn't have. Secondly, Jonathan Ticini is an impecunious candidate in the great progressive tradition. I think it's still unclear that you can have a meaningful challenge in this country unless a multimillionaire happens to want your job. And so they're in two very different situations. And lastly, by the way, Senator Clinton, for a couple of years now, has been backpedaling on this. And unlike Senator Lieberman, did not seek a spotlight from which to continue to espouse the president's position on the war. And so their immediate differences, because Jonathan Ticini doesn't have the kind of money Ned Lamont has, and because the Senator Clinton's been quieter lately, there's been a difference. But for all mainstream Democrats, watching what's happened to Lieberman, it's like a herd of gazelles seeing one cut down from the herd by the lions. Again, even should the senator, you know, escape today with his political life, they've watched this primary. I think it's the most important primary since Gene McCarthy took on Lyndon Johnson in New Hampshire in 1968 over the Vietnam War. And I think you see many similarities of the old line liberals in 1968, many of the civil rights leaders, because of Johnson's performance on those issues, all of the old labor leaders stuck with Johnson. And McCarthy had to form a kind of adhocracy of unbidden progressives from campus organizations all over the country pouring into New Hampshire. Here, I think the bloggers have played some of that role. You have a similar situation in Washington in which the Democratic Leadership Council of the moderates and the sort of Sierra Club, League of Conservation Voters, AFL, they've become not so much grassroots organizations as national lobbies with mailing lists. Their heart is in a subcommittee. If your home is Washington and your job is lobbying, your hobby has to be the care and feeding of incumbents. And one of the things you feel with the Lieberman race is this tremendous outpouring of dissatisfaction from people who feel that no one's been speaking for them for a long time. Everyone within that leadership cadre, not just Senator Clinton, everyone's looking at this and seeing the effect. I really believe, again, that in the primary debate within the Democratic Party, which in some ways will be the political debate that moves the country beginning after November, the effect of this of this race in Connecticut is going to be really, really dramatic.
Bill Curry, I heard something like 14,000 people from Connecticut became Democrats by yesterday at noon. What is the significance of this number? How does the primary work?
Well, let's look at it this way. First of all, it's the first time Democratic registration has risen like this in my adult lifetime. Again, people are no longer identifying with political parties in this country. When I was a kid, the Democrats were far and away the largest party. The unaffiliateds are now, and it's been shrinking. And every so often, you have to have these kinds of fights to draw people in. I believe that most of that, it's very hard. You mentioned, Amy, that there's been a recent poll showing the race tightening. In some ways, I think it's one of the very few late polls I've ever seen that's not a public disservice, in that we have a gubernatorial race here as well in the shadows of this. And that poll showed both races tightening. So at least it will be encouraging people to participate. Their sense of what's at stake will go up as a result of reading it. I don't think that it's accurate. I think that those registrations you talked about, I think those are mostly Lamont registrations. Again, I'm guessing here. My crystal ball has been on the fritz for a while. But the feel of it is that those are Lamont, to me, is that those are Lamont registrations. The tightening polls, they purport to be polling likely voters. In American polling, the two questions, one, are you a regular churchgoer, and two, are you a likely voter, are the two questions people are most likely to fib about. And you end up polling a lot of people who aren't paying such close attention and don't have such feelings. Incumbents tend to do better in them. People who are better known or spent more money on television tend to do better in them. In this race, my guess is that it's moving in a different direction and that we're seeing an increase in the energy level of the electorate here, a rare increase, a rare uptick in that because of the importance of what's at stake.
Bill Curry, we have to break, but when we come back, I want to ask about Senator Joseph Lieberman saying if he doesn't win today's primary, he will run as an independent. And that's something he needs about 7,500 signatures for by the end of tomorrow. Bill Curry is former Connecticut state controller and state senator, sat next to Senator Lieberman when he, too, was a state senator. And we will talk about these issues. Then it will be joined in studio by the advisory director of Morgan Stanley. His name is Dr. Richard Debs. We're going to talk about what's happening in Lebanon. Stay with us.
Here that build the big guns. Here that build the death planes. Here that build all the bombs. Here that hide behind walls. Here that hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but built to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain.
Bob Dylan, Masters of War, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Our guest is Bill Curry, former Connecticut state controller and state senator, counselor to President Clinton, currently writing a weekly column for the Hartford Courant. We're talking about the most watched primary in the country. It's happening today in Connecticut, and it is Joseph Lieberman, three-term incumbent senator, and he's being challenged by Ned Lamont. Joseph Lieberman's plans if he doesn't win today's primary, Bill Curry.
Well, I'm not exactly sure. His stated plan is to file sufficient petitions tomorrow, the deadline's tomorrow at 4 p.m., to qualify to run as an independent. And there's been a great deal of pressure already from others within the party to discourage him. I think that a lot of this depends on, number one, how does he really feel? Is he in a kind of John Paul Jones mood, or is he more in shell shock? Does he, if he loses this, is it by a wide margin, or is it closer? And then thirdly, there's a question here of the Republican nominee. It's been reported that when the Republican nominee, Alan Schlesinger, was nominated at their convention, that the delegates made sheep-like bleeding noises because he was a sacrificial lamb in their views. He is as close to a nullity as you could possibly find in major party politics. A professional card counter who recently admitted that he had forged what's called a wampum card at the Indian casinos that gets you free shrimp. He later had to disclose that he'd been sued by casinos on bad debts and that even though he was a professional card counter, he had never won. He has about 8% in the polls. Lieberman's prospects as in the general election, once he led the general by a wide margin, my guess is that should Lamont win today, that margin will also narrow. And whether or not Schlesinger remains in this race after all of these disclosures regarding the rest of his life, is a big, big question. Schlesinger could be Joe Lieberman's ticket to reelection. If there's someone in that Republican slot whom Republicans simply can't vote for, you get not only the ones who'd be inclined toward Lieberman, but lots of others who feel they haven't a choice. Should he depart and a stronger candidate replace him, I think that would also affect it. Also, this is, has an effect on there are at least two, possibly three congressional races here in just our little state that are very close and in which the outcome in the House could depend. And there's a pretty bitter disagreement as to whether or not Lieberman's presence as an independent candidate in November would impede their prospects, the prospect of the Democratic candidates, of winning control.
Bill Curry, we had invited both candidates into our studio. Ned Lamont took us up on the offer, and I asked him how much pressure there was on him not to run.
I think he's representing himself. I think that the people of Connecticut have it right. They know that stay the course is not a winning strategy. It's time for us to change course, time for us to get our troops out of harm's way and start bringing them home. And I don't think the senator has been in the state. He hasn't listened. And I think he's wrong on that.
How much pressure was there on you not to run, not to weaken a Democratic candidate in this midterm time when the Democrats could take the House and Senate?
There was some of the party brass in State Central there in Hartford, Connecticut, didn't like the idea of a primary. They thought we might be rocking the boat, don't jeopardize a safe seat. But by the same token, I can tell you that the grassroots support was overwhelming. And that's at the town committee level, the delegates at the convention, as you pointed out, where we far exceeded anybody's expectations. And I think going forward, people realize that this is good for the Democratic Party. We're having an old-fashioned kitchen table debate about what type of a party we are, what do we stand for. It's for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. And on August 9th, we get together again and we go forward. So I think it's going to be good for the Democrats, and I think the party brass will eventually come around to that.
We did that interview on June 6th. Bill Curry, final comment on who Ned Lamont is, where he comes from.
Well, I've had some long conversations with him. First of all, he's a bright, very capable guy. He strikes me somewhat closer to Lieberman in his own politics than people, some of his supporters may expect. He describes himself as a centrist. The New York Times, in their strong endorsement of him, called him a moderate. I think in this general election, whether Lieberman is a candidate or not, should Lamont win, he'll be at pains to present himself that way. There are lots of things that they haven't gotten to. What is your theory of national security? We've moved past the age of nation states and past the age of fossil fuels, and we're still presenting ourselves as the first superpower. We're going to war over oil, among other things, for sure. And what is a theory of national security based on mutual security and cooperation? We need a whole new approach. That kind of thinking isn't in a political debate in an election. A fundamental question, though, of whether this political party, the Democrats, is about to stand up more strongly than it has against the cowboy unilateralism of the Bush administration and against the divisive cultural politics that have racked this country. I think coming out of tonight, there'll be at least an improvement in that. But the Democrats will know a little better than they have in a long time what they're not for.
Bill Curry, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Former Connecticut state controller and state senator, currently writing a weekly column for the Hartford Courant. Yes, the primary in Connecticut is today, and we'll certainly bring you more on this race tomorrow on Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Broadcasts on now. We're broadcasting on over 500 radio and television stations. We're broadcasting on 50 radio stations throughout Latin America and North America, Spanish stations, and 450 public radio and TV stations throughout the country on NPR, Pacifica Radio, Low Power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org, where our transcripts can also be found. Well, as we enter the fifth week of Israel's attack on Lebanon, it is intensifying. At least 69 people were reported killed Monday. The deadliest attack occurred in Beirut when an Israeli missile struck a densely populated residential building, killing 15 people. Israel's now threatening to bomb any vehicle driven in southern Lebanon. Israel's also warned residents of southern Lebanon not to go outdoors after 10 p.m. The southern city of Tyre is now largely cut off from the rest of the world. All bridges out of the city have been destroyed. Meanwhile, on the diplomatic front, the Arab League has opposed the U.S. written resolution to end the fighting because it's seen as, well, biased towards Israel. The resolution doesn't require Israel to immediately pull out of Lebanon. Our next guest is a Lebanese-American and former chair of the board of American University of Beirut. Dr. Richard Debs is advisory director of Morgan Stanley, a member of its international advisory board. He joined Morgan Stanley in 1976 as the founding president of Morgan Stanley International. We welcome you to Democracy Now.
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Your thoughts on Lebanon today?
That is a wide open question. My thoughts are that it's a dismal situation. I really am very distraught about it, as most of the world is. I don't see the reason for us being in this situation. I just can't believe that we, Americans, let ourselves into this. People are being killed on both sides. Innocent people are being killed. And this, in my view, could have been managed much better going back by our government to avoid this kind of situation. It's tragic. And we, the Lebanese people, are now suffering. The country will be really put back many years. Actually, scars that we won't recover from. But more than that, I think America itself is wounding itself in such a way that it's going to take us decades to recover from what we've done here.
What do you think was the major mistake that was made?
By us? The major mistake was letting this situation in the Middle East fester as it has. Benign neglect or malign neglect, whatever the case was, this government would not play the role that it should have as the major power in the world, with great influence over Israel, obviously. And no longer does this president have the role of a peacemaker, that is, even-handed, you know, the even-handed policy we've had or attempted to have over the years. And basically let the situation get out of control.
The timetable that's often given is that this began in mid-July when Hezbollah abducted two Israeli soldiers. Mm. Is that your timetable?
No,
is that how you see it?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. This is not a one-shot recent affair. This has been, this situation, really you have to go back many decades, but more recently, this is the way the Lebanese look at it, and most of the Middle East, including those who would rather see Hezbollah disappear. Going back to the civil war in Lebanon, had been caused by many reasons, many parties involved, sectarian and so forth, but also foreign interference, including that of Israel, who went in the early 80s and occupied, bombed Beirut, bombed Lebanon, in much the same way as they are doing now. But it was in 82 or so that Hezbollah itself was organized. And from 82 until 2000, Israel occupied the southern part of Lebanon after having created devastation in the country itself, which took a long time. It never did recover, never did recover. The south was in terrible shape. The poorer Lebanese lived there. The occupation lasted all that time. And Hezbollah was created not just as a military force, but as a welfare organization, like a state within a state. They took care of the people there. The Lebanese government could not get there to do it. The army couldn't get there to do it. The police couldn't get there to do it. Hezbollah was the government, in effect. They were seen, perceived as the Lebanese, and I say most of the Middle East, as having, after many skirmishes and so forth with the Israelis, forced the Israelis out of Lebanon in 2000. And in that respect, Israel looks upon it as a peace-giving measure of retreating from an occupied territory. The Arabs in general look upon it as a victory for this group of guerrillas who forced the Israelis out of Lebanon. Since then, there have been many skirmishes on that border, many skirmishes. Many people were killed on both sides. And there were prisoner exchanges between Hezbollah kidnapping Israelis, taking as prisoners Lebanese, whom they still hold in captivity. As I understand it, from everything I've heard, Hezbollah intended this kidnapping as the basis for a prisoner exchange. I don't think that they expected the kind of reaction from Israel that they got. But whatever the case was, and when you look back chronologically, the first attack was by Hezbollah going across the border, doing the kidnappings, which are illegal, there's no doubt about it, but it's happened before. And then the retaliation by Israel at Lebanon, not just at Hezbollah, because they couldn't, I think the Israelis were surprised as well as to their inability to get to where the Hezbollah guerrillas are. That in itself, the bombing of Lebanon in itself, was the real weak point in this whole strategy. But the reaction of Hezbollah at that point was to throw these missiles into Israel itself, killing many innocent people over there, but not beginning the conflagration, but responding to what the Israeli incursion was. The first reaction by many Lebanese and many Arabs was, you know, it's a pity that Hezbollah did this and creating this situation or causing, inflaming it. It didn't take long for the Middle East, in view of what Israel did to Lebanon itself and innocent people being killed and the infrastructure being destroyed, it's amazing what has happened now in the country itself, to think, to change their view of Lebanon, even those who were opposed to Hezbollah and would rather have seen it just disappear, as considering them the heroes, the resistant fighters against this aggressive state, and not just Israel. In the Middle East, it's now considered the American war against the Arabs. That's what it's gotten down to. And this is going to haunt us for many, many years. I think I don't see why we took this position blatantly. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's not subtle. It's not diplomatic or anything. The president says it over and over, and our Secretary of State says it over and over. We do not want a ceasefire. We will not press for a ceasefire until certain conditions are met. And this has been going on, as you know, for many weeks. In the meanwhile, every day, more people are killed on both sides. And I'm sure the Lebanese dead count is going to exceed 1,000 people easily by the time this is over. Not to mention those who are wounded, but more importantly, those who are left behind. Those who are left behind, the refugees who've left their towns and villages, those who have received them in northern Lebanon. The economy is just devastated. Those people are alive and will be around for a long time. And they won't forget this American position of not wanting to stop the violence and the killing until Israel achieved its objectives.
We're talking to Dr. Richard Debs. He is the advisory director of Morgan Stanley. He is chair emeritus of the Board of Trustees of American University of Beirut. When we come back, I want to ask about your own family history, your second generation Lebanese American, and talk about the banking community here. Stay with us.
وقبل للبحر
Beydouz Lebedout here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest today is Dr. Richard Debs. He's the former president of Morgan Stanley International and chair emeritus of the board of American University of Beirut, now an advisory director at Morgan Stanley. I wanted to ask you a question about a piece that appeared recently in the New York Times. It talked about the differing views of Lebanese American business community over the Israeli invasion. The article quotes the investment fund manager Ziad Abdelnour, who describes himself as a neoconservative and says that he supports Israel's attack. The quote, "There is no other way but to absolutely annihilate Hezbollah. I bleed when I see my country suffering like this, but you can't build a Hong Kong and harbor terrorists. The Lebanese cannot have their cake and eat it, too." Abdelnour added many other Lebanese agree with him but are unwilling to speak out. Do you agree with that assessment?
I disagree with him, and I disagree with his assessment that other Lebanese are not speaking out, because that isn't true. And I think what he said is not inconsistent, with what a lot of people think. And it also, you have to keep in mind that that article came out early on in this onslaught, when it wasn't very clear whether or not Israel could jump in and clean out Hezbollah, so to speak, and get rid of that cancer, as those his enemies call it. But the reaction of most of the other Arab states was similar to that. That is to say, Hezbollah is an annoyance and a problem for them, the governments. But now, as you know, their attitude has changed completely, because the street in the Middle East is completely opposed to what Israel and the U.S. are doing. And the governments themselves, well, as witnessed by what's going on with the Arab League today, the governments themselves have completely had to change their positions toward Hezbollah. They have to regard it now, despite what they like to do, they have to regard it now as a resistance force against an onslaught in Lebanon, killing innocent Lebanese people. And those governments are in a position where, you know, they are very reluctant to speak out. I'm talking now about Egypt and Jordan and so forth, the ones closest to us politically. They have very grave reservations about criticizing U.S. policy outright like that. But their people are clearly expressing their views. And they are afraid. Number one, they see the injustice of the situation. And number two, they're afraid for their own positions. This can't go on, this American incursion in creating a new Middle East, as the Secretary of State said, going through the birthing pains of creating a new Middle East. A new Middle East for what? A new Middle East for the benefit of Israel and the United States. That's the view over there. Those are code words. Democracy has become a code word, I'm sorry to say, and not a good code word in the Middle East. Democracy stands for, now, in their perception, the idea of American sovereignty over the whole area. It's and Israeli incursions into the whole area. It's a very sad situation. So in terms of the Lebanese in this country, the ones I know, the American Task Force for Lebanon and so forth and so on.
What is the American Task Force in Lebanon?
It's an organization of mostly Lebanese Americans, mostly, but others, many Americans as well, I mean non-Lebanese, who are more or less a constituency for Lebanon, has been for many years. It's been going, I don't know how long, but many decades here. And it's clear that they are opposed to what's going on in terms of the Israeli onslaught in Lebanon. Hezbollah is another issue. At this point, the question is, why is this continuing as it is? Why hasn't the United States and its ally Israel? It's not an ally. I mean, the U.S. and Israel are in this together, clearly. Why is this permitted to continue? The killing. there must be some other way to deal with this without killing innocent people, without letting innocent people be killed.
Do you see this as a proxy war for the United States with Syria and Iran?
Well,
or the beginning of a war?
Well, clearly, the U.S. would like to see change of regime in Syria and Iran. They would love it, obviously. It's very obvious. The question of how this falls into that tactic, that strategy, falls into it. I think that the excuse of the kidnapping, I think the kidnapping was used as an excuse to try to get not just rid of Hezbollah, but to upset the whole situation in the Middle East.
But then Israel says there have been more than 1,000 missiles that have been fired at them, and they want to rout out Hezbollah so that can't happen again.
After the onslaught. Yeah, there were 1,000. Going back, there were always these ineffective missiles that have been lobbed over into Israel, doing very little harm. Now, what everybody's surprised at is how effective. They have new missiles now. They're more effective, and they have many of them. But remember that the kidnapping itself was the first move. The second move was Israel bombing Lebanon. The third move were these missiles coming out of Lebanon from Hezbollah. So, clearly this is part, in my view, this is consistent with our animosity towards Syria and Iran. On the other hand, we handed Iraq over to Iran, in my view. We went into Iraq, we split the country up, and I've been around for a long time in that, and I go back many years visiting the Middle East and so forth. There was never this kind of Shia-Sunni split that people talk about. This is a recent development that's been emphasized and aggravated by our policy in Iraq.
Let me ask you, Dr. Richard Debs, you are a leading member of the American establishment. I mean, the former president of Morgan Stanley International, leading financier in this country. Not just talking about Lebanese Americans and Arab Americans, how do the other people in the banking community, your colleagues, feel about what's going on?
Well, when you look at what's going on in terms of what's happening to Lebanon, everybody I know, including my Jewish friends as well, think that this is a catastrophe, the killing of these people. On both sides, mind you, both sides. In Lebanon, they're just more being killed. And the country's being destroyed.
And yet, hear this. There are very few voices on television right now that are speaking out against what is happening.
Correct. Because it is being, when the House and the Senate passed these resolutions early on in support of anything Israel wanted to do, basically defense, didn't mention the humanitarian aspects of it at all. That sort of set the stage for support, apparent support, of the Bush policy in the Middle East. And I think the Democrats have made a huge mistake in going along with this position. Because you're right, the official position of the U.S., the White House, and the Congress itself is that of complete support of Israel with no real interest or no apparent interest in what's happening in Lebanon. And it is put forth, the government of Israel puts it forth as, a major priority of the state and the existence. It's existential. It's become to that. I mean, they use those words. So anyone who wants to speak out in opposition to Israeli policy, it puts himself at risk of being attacked just for that, taking that position.
Is there any move within the Arab American establishment here in this country, in the banking community, which you say is well beyond Arab American, including Jewish bankers, to make a statement now, to speak out? And what role do you think the media plays in all of this?
Well, I think people have been waiting, expecting this to stop. And when that happens, then we can have a sensible discourse about peace in the Middle East and what we do about it and so forth, the U.S. role. And I think everyone's caught by surprise. There have been statements made, but no, this is a political hot potato, and people don't know what to do about it except to lament the fact that innocents are being killed. I mean, on that you have unanimity. But apart from that, going to the causes and the reasons and the solutions, no, it's a pretty risky political situation.
And what about the American University of Beirut? I know you can't speak for it. You're the former chair of the board. What has happened?
Well, I keep, obviously, in touch with it. The situation there is that the American State Department pressured all Americans to leave Lebanon. They want, in view of our policy there, any American who was killed, that situation would have been very embarrassing for Americans and Israelis. So they wanted to get all the Americans out, and they put real pressure on getting them out. And most of them did leave.
How did they put pressure?
They got out through as well as they could. You can't get out anymore. I mean, now it's all sealed off. Israel has bombed all of the bridges north of Beirut as well. And so many of our administrative people, hundreds, had to leave, did leave. The doctors, however, most of them stayed behind. We have a hospital which is running and taking care of the sick and wounded. However, the problem there is not, the campus itself is fine. I mean, everyone has an interest in maintaining it and the hospital. So I think, and hopefully, I don't want to make any predictions, but hopefully that'll be fine. The problem here is the lack of fuel and electricity, therefore, and food. And as my latest report is that the whole country has about 7 days left of fuel. I mean, they're going to run out in 7 days. No trucks are coming in. There's no relief there. The hospital itself has power for only 10 hours a day. Maximum.
We're going to have to leave it there. 5 seconds, final statement.
We keep our fingers crossed and hope that some sensible, rational solution will be found by the world community.
Dr. Richard Debs, I want to thank you for being with us again. Former president of Morgan Stanley International, former chair of the board of American University of Beirut. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. You can go to our website for transcript, for links to other groups. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shrihoud Okadus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin, Uri Galed. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.